Being an American Express Platinum card member with Global Dining Access by Resy helped you score tickets to quite the dining experience. One bite and you're speechless. That's the powerful backing of American Express. See how to elevate your dining experiences at americanexpress.com/withAmex. Terms apply.
Fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama lion. Can't know a high-toned woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons.
It's a love that I find ever since you've been around. Your love put me on the top of the world. Top of the world.
Permit me here and now to promise, as a good comrade and a fellow artist, that I will not report any of this, whatever it is, to the police.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast. Each week, our intrepid group of researchers and music archivists dig through the record crates of the world, finding those albums that may have been lost over time. If a new artist is discovered along the way, well, that's all the better. Using a patent-pending algorithm and spirited debate, we pick one album as an inroad to discuss. Once that is settled, we reach out to the artists and invite them into Thunderlove Studio to chat with your hosts, Keith R. Higgins and Jeff Calhoun. When we're lucky, they say yes. Our mission with Abandoned Albums is simple: to make sure artists' recorded work remains, or in some cases, lands on, the cultural radar. We invite you to sit back and relax. Thank you for joining us.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. You caught me just finishing up some editing on Getting Real with John and Beth. I want to share my first experience with Factor Meals for you. I think you'll find this interesting because I bet the same thing happens to you. I had just received my first shipment from Factor Meals the other day, and I was excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals for myself. Anyway, I was working away and noticed it was very late, and it was my night to make dinner. I jumped up and headed to the kitchen, went to grab the ingredients for the dish I was going to make, and realized I was missing a prime ingredient. Well, I could make a run to the store, or I could make one of my new Factor meals. Actually, the choice was easy. I grabbed a cavatappi, an Italian-style pork ragu with garlic broccoli, heated the oven per instructions, and minutes later was enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. It really was everything Factor Meals said it would be. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off.
Stacy, do you- We close out this year by tipping our hat to Fountain of Wayne's third album, Welcome Interstate Managers, as it celebrates its 20th birthday. The album would come to represent a pinnacle in the band's career. Fountains of Wayne were Chris Collingwood on lead vocals and rhythm guitar. Adam Schlesinger is on bass, backing vocals, and the occasional lead vocal. Jody Porter played lead guitar and supplied backing vocals, and Brian Young was on drums and percussion. Welcome Interstate Managers strikes a balance between melancholy and humor, crafting songs that combine catchy pop melodies with witty, often sardonic lyrics, making the record both emotionally resonant and effortlessly enjoyable. The album's standout track, Stacy's Mom, became a cultural phenomenon known for its infectious chorus and humorous take on adolescent infatuation. However, the songs, all written by Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger, made certain that the album is far more than that hit single. The lyrics often explore themes of suburban life, love, and longing, encapsulated in a distinctly American setting. Musically, Interstate Managers is a blend of power pop, rock, and indie, with a polished production that never overwhelms the songwriting. Welcome Interstate Managers' sound is characterized by bright guitar riffs, harmonious vocals, and a rhythm section that provides a solid foundation for the melodies to shine. It's a testament to the band's genius of restraint. We invited writers and power pop scholars S.W. Lawden and Nadja D. to help us understand why, 20 years later, Welcome Interstate Managers can still capture your attention and keep your air guitar amp at 11. Here is Keith's conversation with Steve and Nadja about this career-defining album.
It's just the normal noises in here.
We have gathered here this evening to talk about the one, the only Fountains of Wayne, Welcome Interstate Managers.
Yes.
Celebrating its 20-year mark. Joining me today, this evening, S.W. Lawden and Nadja D. Welcome.
Hello.
So, why do we care?
Well, if I knew you were going to start with the hard questions, I probably wouldn't have come on the show. I mean, I thought we were going to do some softball questions first.
I mean, I'll just jump in and say this is definitely one of my very favorite power pop records of the 2000s. Like, there is just something about this record. It has an undeniable hit in Stacy's Mom. It's got Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger, the two main songwriters, writing some of their hands down best songs that they ever wrote. And these guys wrote good songs in their sleep, but these are like some of their best songs. But it's also got a mythology to it because, you know, much like what Wilco was going through with Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, they got dropped and had to kind of find their own way forward before they had their big hit and took this next leap in their career. So the mythology around it and the quality of the art kind of combined to make something that's like just a little more interesting than your average album. At least that's how I think about it. Nadja, how do you think about it?
It's an album that just, it has only grown in time, in lore of legend of it. There's people who say they love the first, you know, half of the album, the first 8 or 9 songs, and then it falls off for them. But I think of it as it's a group of old friends that I just get to know and cherish each song, especially with the passing of Adam Schlesinger, and knowing that this is all we have now from that great man, from this band, because, you know, they're probably over now. And what's funny is, you know, Stacy's Mom, to talk about the elephant in the room, that's not even my favorite song on this album. And I think most people who hear this album, they might be coming to it through Stacy's Mom, which is great. It's a great, you know, door opener. But then they're going to walk away with Hacky Sack or Hackensack.
Hackensack, yeah.
Hackensack. Or, you know, any of the other, there's so many great songs. It's hard to pick one great song on this album.
Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain again with something every podcast listener and music junkie needs to hear. As I'm sure you can guess, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I also listen to a lot of music, so having high-quality headphones and earbuds are absolutely critical to my day. Oh, and I have numerous pairs. In fact, I have a junk drawer of used devices that have bitten the dust, so I've tried them all. Recently, I was sent a pair of earbuds by Raycon, and the first thing I noticed was the cost. Looks like their products are about half the price of other premium brands. Okay, that's cool. And the reviews seem pretty stellar. Okay, checks that box. So I got my Raycon Everyday Earbuds, a nice packaging to open, and what I immediately noticed were the pack of ear tips for sizing. I'll tell ya, I have small ear canals, I know, a flaw. So to see choices for the best fit, especially while exercising, oh yeah. And yes, they were immediately comfortable. Sound quality was great too. Plus, I have three EQ options that I love because I like more bass in my music and less in the podcasts. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise canceling, and awareness mode all included. I think I'm in business, and I just realized I've had them in all day. Like I said, super comfortable. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon.
What is power pop? Power pop is full of hooks. It's typically upbeat. It's power chord driven rock and roll.
I think, Steve, I was reading in your article that the band themselves are reluctant to refer to themselves as power pop. They refer to themselves as rock and roll band. Why the need to put them in that power pop category if they themselves don't see themselves that way?
Well, I mean, kind of answering your question tongue in cheek, part of being a power pop band is denying you're a power pop band, right? Like that's like part of the definition, right? Listen, artists don't like to be pigeonholed. I think that's true for most genres. You know, maybe less so for a punk band who they want to be punk, or a heavy metal band that wants to be heavy metal. But you get into this subgenre debate, and people are like, no, we're a punk band, not a pop punk band, you know, and you can just keep splitting the hairs. I think too, and I've written about this and have curated books where people have written about this at length. There's a little bit of a stigma to power pop, simply because power pop had a very brief commercial moment, most notably around The Knack and My Sharona, right? Very early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And a bunch of bands got signed in the wake of My Sharona's success that were in the same sort of skinny tie, shag haircut, hooks, you know, energy, harmony, melody, all the hallmarks of the power pop genre. And so labels signed a bunch of these bands. And then this thing called the Knacklash happened. The Knacklash, first, media started turning on the Knack because, from what I've read anyway, I was way too young at the time to be aware of any of this, but what I read was they weren't the most friendly people in interviews and could be a tough interview and kind of came across as arrogant or combative, I guess is the way I understand it. Maybe Nadia has a better perspective on that, but then the media started turning on them, and then the song was getting played so much the consumers started turning on them. And subsequently, a lot of these bands that got signed in the wake of their success with My Sharona got dropped. And that creates this legacy of power pop is a quick way to obscurity. So please, if you're going to call me anything, don't call me power pop. That's one way of looking at it. I've heard this debated a lot of different ways. Nadia, what's your perspective on that?
The same thing happened with grunge, though. You know, everybody was hopping on, trying to find the next Nirvana, Bush, Stone Temple Pilots, all that happened. And then there's a backlash because you get oversaturated with that market. So, yeah, that happening with the Knack was really unfortunate. And again, Mike Sharona is not even my favorite Knack song, you know? So, but, you know, that's like deeper cuts for when you start really diving into a band that you like and you're like, oh, they got to be more than just this.
But you do also, there's an interesting thing of this genre in particular, where at least when I've been a big fan of punk for a very long time, various kinds of punk. And I listen to something and I go, oh, that's a punk band and that's a punk album and these are punk songs. With power pop, though, you can pretty quickly end up going song by song rather than album or catalog. So you're like, well, Southern Girls is a power pop Cheap Trick song, but not the song before or the song after it. And Cheap Trick has written some great power pop songs, but are they a power pop band? Probably not. They just are a rock band that's capable of writing some good power pop songs. So you can really start splitting the hairs. And there are a lot of debates about, you know, but is it power pop? And people want to talk about what is and what isn't and what qualifies. And the purists are going to be, it has to sound like these specific five things from the 50s, 60s. The people who grew up in the 90s are going to be like, it kind of has to sound like Matthew Sweet or Teenage Fan Club, right? It's all perspective. But people get really, really dug in on these perspectives and these opinions they build. That whole debate that happens in the fan universe of power pop is another reason why bands don't want to be called power pop.
I listened to your Moog Trooper interview on power pop. And of course, that's in, you know, the first book, right? This one. Mm-hmm. talking power pop with the Whiffs. And he said, a slightly pathetic and vulnerable admission dressed up in razor sharp, jangly guitars and chest beating bluster. Which is a mouthful, but it's also it's a better definition than what you mostly hear or read on Wikipedia. And I was waiting for you to ask me it, to go, what's your definition of power pop?
Oh, it was coming.
And I was going to ask, do you want a two-word definition? Do you want a long definition? Or do you want like somewhere in between? And so I put together all of those. If you want a two-word definition, the best one is John Bryan was asked, you know, musician, singer, songwriter, John Bryan was asked to define what kind of music he writes. And he thought for a while and he said, unpopular pop, which I thought was hilarious and perfect, right? My pet peeve is when I tell people who don't know about power pop that I like power pop, they assume I'm talking about like Christina Aguilera or... you know, mainstream pop. That's what I call it. It's not power pop. My short definition, that's longer than two words, and this is my words, is it's a short song, go-go danceable, retro, guitar-driven with jangly guitars, vocal harmonies, and lyrics about lovers that you're longing for.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip-on tie and a rub-on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie, look what they're doing to me. Trying to trip me up, trying to wear me down. Julie, I swear it's so hard to bear it. And I'd never make it through without you around. No, I'd never make it through without you around. Hours on the phone making pointless calls. I got a desk full of paper that means nothing at all. Sometimes I catch myself staring into space, counting down the hours till I get to see your face. Hey, Julie, look what they're doing to me. Trying to trip me up, trying to wear me down. Julie, I swear it's so hard to bear it. And I'd never make it through without you around. No, I'd never make it through without you.
And then I have my long definition, which I'll read to you. And this is kind of going off of, so I have a friend, David Thompson. He's from Boston. He's been in quite a few bands, The Pills, The Pop Cycle. he claimed or said that power pop, you can't call bands like in the 60s, Beatles, The Who, these bands who invented power pop, because they were in it at the time. So it has to be bands that come after those bands in order for it to make sense. What he said was, the basic definition of the genre has to be music made after 1970s that sounds a lot like the Beatles. And I think it sounds a lot like early to mid Beatles, but that wasn't popular to do because people were then moved on and were looking for the next best thing, which I think is actually really smart. Although people will quote that Buddy Holly was one of the first power pop artists. And yeah, I give, you know, some weight to that for sure. My long definition now, if you're ready for it.
Give it to me.
Post-mid-60s Beatles songs that sound like they're lost Beatles songs or illegitimate children from a test tube that combine the musical DNA of the Beatles' catchy song hooks, the Beach Boys' vocal harmonies, the Birds' jangly guitars, the power of bands like The who are plugging in their first electric guitar set to a drum backbeat. And then I wrote extra points if you have a nasally lead singer, lyrics that rhyme, and hand claps.
Very good. Thank you. Those are all three magnificent. Wasn't it Michael Chabon who, in your book that you edited, who had also had a brilliant definition of power pop?
My memory's terrible. I wouldn't be able to just rattle that off.
True power pop is rueful and celebratory at the same time, glorifying desire and frustration, which is why so many power pop songs concern themselves with the subject of tonight, or tomorrow night, or Saturday night, or some other night that will only be perfect for as long as it can be deferred. Power pop at its purest is the music of hit records that miss.
That whole essay was unbelievable.
Yeah.
That first book, Go All the Way, was actually built around that Chabon essay.
Really?
Yeah, it was the first thing we had, and then we went and got the rest of the contributions.
Yeah, his chapter on power pop is a perfect one to give somebody if they want to learn about power pop and they have no idea, or if they know and they want to go a little deeper.
So Fountains of Wayne, I pulled up a review, and Robert Christgau is sort of he's like the bane of my existence. He's a little too snooty for my tastes, but he gave the record, Welcome Interstate Managers, an A-. Now, if you know or read anything by Robert Christgau, he does not hand out grades like that very often. But let's go back a couple of records. Would we say, I am admittedly unfamiliar with their entire canon, would we say they have always been power pop?
They would not say that.
I want to quote from Adam Schlesinger on what he, when he was talking about power pop in Fountains of Wayne. He said, it's definitely a double-edged sword. We never identified ourselves as power pop. We thought of ourselves as a rock band. And I guess just by the nature of what we wrote, it turned out what some people would call power pop. But I think power pop has a negative connotation as well, sort of trying to rewrite something that's already been written a million times before and just doing it over and over in the same exact way, endlessly rehashing some fictitious golden era. We certainly didn't set out with that as our goal. We just tried to write songs that we like, and we like melody. So we focus more on melody than, say, a guitar riff. We feel like the music we're making is current pop or rock. We're not sitting around reminiscing about the bygone days. And that's from Washington Post article.
Fair enough.
He's pushing back, I think, really eloquently against the sort of nostalgia that I was talking about, that people get trapped. Mm-hmm. Certain kinds of power pop artists who obviously start off as power pop bands can get a little trapped in the specificity of it. Mm-hmm. And then if you're a musician who's trying to do something current and think that you're pushing boundaries and doing all the things that a modern current rock band will want to do, you can see where that would create some friction and dissonance for you, because you don't want to be in some nostalgic cover band.
Yeah, I wrote a joke. What does a power pop band and 999 megabytes have in common? Neither one gets you a gig.
Oh, man.
That was one of my Power Pop memes, Steve. You probably saw it.
But, yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I love that.
I mean, I think it is. I think a lot of bands, maybe not today, but I think a lot of bands think of being labeled as power pop as kind of a kiss of death, you know, that unpopular pop.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Actually, nowadays you're seeing more bands owning it.
They are.
It's having a really interesting moment where bands are owning it. And then that causes the reverse thing with some of the older fans, because they're like, well, you guys aren't really power pop. And it's like, you finally have bands that are owning this label.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, well, but they don't, you know, and then, you know, that's us. That's this community that we belong to. But I think Fountains of Wayne's a classic case of a pop rock band, which was in the alternative rock era in the 90s, that just wrote rock and roll songs with hooks. And the power pop fans gravitated to them and claimed them. Mm. But they were also some of their biggest supporters, right? So that is this like reciprocal relationship where it's like, well, we didn't think we were necessarily power pop or a rock band, but man, all these people over here are saying really great things about us, and we love that somebody likes our music. Well, the flag that that group of people's waving is power pop.
Right.
And they've been the most consistently, in my opinion, the most consistently and outspoken fans of Fountains of Wayne ever since. They're still flying the flag for Fountains of Wayne. When if you say Fountains of Wayne to a room full of people in a restaurant, two or three might go, is that the Stacey's Mom band? Like, that's all they know.
Yeah.
But the Power Pop fans are deep. They're going to tell you why Joy Ray is a fantastic song off the first record.
We lost Adam in 2021.
20,
I think.
20.
Yeah, he was one of the, sadly, one of the first, earliest notable deaths, I think, around COVID.
Yeah, and they thought he was going to pull through.
Yeah, it was real tragedy.
I talked to Mike Viola recently about it, and the one thing that he would share was that we all thought he was going to be okay.
Was the band on hiatus? What happened? Because I get a little murky between my Ivy and Fountains of Wayne overlap and where goes into what. I think Fountains of Wayne came first, and then there was a little lull, and then Ivy took off. Or do I have my time period wrong?
Ivy, I think, was first before Fountains of Wayne came around.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think it was due to things like Adam's songwriting for, you know, movies and television and stuff that helped him to be able to make this album that we're talking about. And it might've been money too from Ivy or something, but it was all his money that financed the album, because all the other labels that were interested wanted demos, which it's like, this is their third album and you want demos from these guys?
I'm going to pose this question. I don't know if I've ever asked this of you, Steve. I have a third album theory.
Okay.
That bands that have longevity really seem to knock it out of the park on their third album. And I'll give you, you know, Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run, whatever you think of Bon Jovi, Slip, Ruin, Wet, The Police, Zenyatta Mandata. These are bands that went on to have these incredible careers. I think the industry was a lot different back then. They nurtured bands rather than if you didn't sell 100,000 copies of your first record, you're out. I'd like to get your thoughts. This is their third record.
Yeah, and it's that immediately brings to mind the sophomore slump theory, right? Because you know, Utopia Parkway is the album they got dropped behind, mm-hmm. And you do, you know, there. I guess there is some reality to your first record making enough of a mark that it merits making a second record. But because it's the music business, not the music hobby, if the second record doesn't sell, there's a pretty good chance that you're not going to get to make a third record, which is why it's all the more miraculous that the second half of their career starts after they're dropped, and they self-fund an indie record. In part, at least to my ears, part of what makes Welcome Interstate Managers so exciting and why I think it has legs is because they took some real chances on this third record. Stylistically, as Nadia mentioned, some people will sometimes knock them for being stylistically kind of all over the map on this record. But I think part of what they were saying was, well, if we're going to get dropped when we were trying to play the game, right, then let's just make the record we want to make. And then they make this astounding record that really just feels like the art the four of them made together. And they're pouring their hearts and souls and laying their entire musical future on this record. And it pays off.
Yeah.
So I like your third record theory, but I think it's probably more potent or powerful if your second record doesn't really do much.
Which is true. Mm-hmm. Which is absolutely true. I mean, Springsteen's second record didn't do shit.
You guys have heard that theory, why the sophomore record is such a difficult record for a band to make. Do you know that?
May I posit that it is because you have, what, X number of years to write your first record, and then you only have 12 to 14 months to write your second record.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. And you're also under a lot of other pressure. And then maybe you do want to stylistically change your album. I immediately think of Julian Lennon. That first album, The Lot, was fantastic. And then the second one, Secret Value of Daydreaming.
Yeah.
Or Mr. Jordan. I forget which one it was. That was not a good album, even by his own admission. But then he comes out with his third and fourth album, and they're great. And the one that has like Saltwater.
But by then the audience is gone.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? My friend's band are in the studio right now recording their third album. So I'll have to tell them that it better be great.
Yeah. No pressure. Welcome.
You hear that, guys? Pop Cycle guys.
But so I think too, though, like this is the thing about fans of any genre or any specific band. Utopia Parkway got them dropped and didn't have the promised hit that the label wanted or the band had hoped for, or whatever the dynamics were there. I don't know. I wasn't there. But fans like Nadia and I will tell you that Utopia Parkway is a fantastic record. It's a fantastic Fountains of Wayne record. Yeah. It's a fantastic alternative rock record. And it is a fantastic power pop record. I mean, the opening track, Utopia Parkway, is great. Red Dragon Tattoo is hilarious and also great. Denise, and I don't know why this is, but when Fountains of Wayne writes a song with a girl's name as the title, it is always fantastic. That song is unbelievable. And, you know, interestingly, when I interviewed Adam Schlesinger for Go All the Way, when I wrote about Fountains of Wayne, I spoke to him at the end of 2018 about a lot of this. I asked him, what is, do you think, your most power pop song? And he thought about it for a second, and he named the second to last song on Utopia Parkway, which is It Must Be Summer.
It Must Be Summer, yeah.
It must be summer, 'cause the days are long. On the Jersey Shore.
If you get into Fountains of Wayne through Stacey's mom, that's great. It is actually a fantastic song.
Yeah.
But there's more gold on the other side of that within Welcome Interstate Managers. And then if you fall for them there, if that gateway drug leads you into Fountains of Wayne, you're going to love Utopia Parkway and you're going to love the first self-titled album.
Jeff Calhoun, who co-hosts the show with me, can't be here tonight, but I'm going to read what he said and I'll let you discuss. For him, it's Fountain of Wayne's third best album, and I will die on that hill.
Yeah. What are the first two?
He didn't list them.
So that was, I'm just, you know, listen, Jeff, I know you're not here to defend yourself, but making a big statement like that and then not backing it up, I don't know, man. What, I mean, I gotta guess he thinks the first two are the first, are the best records, right?
Or, I mean, there may be Traffic and Weather. Who knows?
Traffic and Weather is also a good one. I mean,
I doubt it's Sky Full of Holes. I mean, that was an album that now I'm so thankful to have, but I didn't immediately take to it.
No, I didn't either. Out of State Plates, though, the B-side compilation is fantastic. Maybe has one of my top five Fountains of Wayne songs of all time. Another Girl's Name, Maureen. I love that song. I cannot get enough of the song Maureen from their B-side compilation album.
I was hoping, Steve, I was hoping you were going to say, I Want an Alien for Christmas.
That's right.
I love that song.
I mean, and that's another thing about Fountains of Wayne. Like, they are such smart songwriters. Like, it's a little troubling when you're peeling back the onions of just how good they are at every facet of songwriting, so much so that they make it seem simple. There's nothing simple about what these guys are doing, the kind of restraint that's kind of like turn on a dime hooks that these guys have in their songs. But they're also not afraid to write just completely goofy lyrics.
People always compare Fountains of Wayne to Oasis.
How can the Prime Minister support a law that makes it illegal for people who, what I'm trying to say is, but is not Oasis the greatest British band since the Beatles? Can we not vote on this?
Enough!
I don't believe that anybody!
Mr. Shelby, you've been warned 7 times this month to stop bringing up Oasis.
Okay, maybe musically there's similarities and crossovers on specific songs, but those guys, personality-wise, could not be more different. It's like Oasis are, you know, they're going to a football game, you know, to drink some pints and punch people in the face, and Fountains of Wayne, they're going to the library because there's a cute librarian that works there.
In your essay, you actually teed up this record with The Graduate. Did you really do that?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me.
I did do it, and I had my husband sit through it with me, and I had watched it one time already to see, is there any traction here? So it was all based on the whole, when you line up Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd with The Wizard of Oz, and it's called Dark Side of Oz, that it lines up and there's these weird things that happen. Like when Judy Garland is singing Over the Rainbow on the Ranch and she looks up to the sky and then you hear the planes in the album go, and it looks like she's looking at those planes. Right. And then with that particular lineup mashup, when the movie goes from sepia tone, black and white, to color, Money starts up and you see the yellow brick road, right? It's just, it's perfect. And it makes you think, did they write this to the movie? And then when I was listening to Welcome Interstate Managers, I was just listening to the songs like, here's a guy, you know, it's about young love in high school and falling in love with someone's mom and all this other stuff. And of course, because I went to film school and worked in the film industry, it made me think of The Graduate. And so I was like, I wonder if that would Dark Side of Moon it if I tried it. So I did, and I tried it. And they're both, surprisingly, by the same studio, MGM. And on Dark Side of the Moon, you started up on the third lion roar, you know. But on this one, it was better if I started it after Simon and Garfunkel's Sound of Silence. Like, I don't want to take away from that. So as soon as that song ends, you start up Welcome Inner Saint Managers. And it's hilarious how much it crosses over.
I took note of
Stacy's
mom starting.
Stacy's mom starts, up to the house. Which, you know, it's that Cars opening refrain, and you see they pull up to the house, and it's perfect. Before that, it's Bright Future in Sales, and if you know the movie The Graduate, Benjamin's just got back from graduating, and so all his mom's friends and neighbors and stuff are over, just congratulating him on, you know, you're going to be the next big salesman, and one guy even goes up to him and...
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
And that's during Bright Future in Sales, which is so hilarious, right? How that crosses over. And then the whole thing with Mrs. Robinson is happening with Stacy's mom, although it's kind of a flip, because in The Graduate, Mrs. Robinson's hitting on Benjamin, and in Stacy's mom, Stacy's friend is in love with Stacy's mom. So it's a little bit of a flip. But I was imagining it from, like, that's what's going on in Benjamin's head, with Stacy's mom thing. And now Benjamin's in Mrs. Robinson's bedroom, and you see Elaine's picture in the background. And Hackensack's all about, you know, I'm such a poor guy. Come back to me when you're back in town. And, you know, that's the girl I should be with. It just lines up really funny. And then in, what was it? There's Annie's, the lyric, Sweet Annie, No Better Place. It's right on Anne Bancroft's face. And if you know that Mrs. Robinson's played by Anne Bancroft, when the song goes Sweet Annie, it's just, I don't know. There were a bunch of really funny things. So, yeah, if you ever are bored on a Friday night and you have nothing better to do and you have a copy of The Graduate and an album, then line them up, and I think you'll get a kick out of it.
Now, have you tried it with American Pie?
No, but I'm game to try it with any other movie.
When I assigned, it was the 20th anniversary of Welcome Interstate Managers, and I was putting the second volume of Remember the Lightning together. And I knew that I wanted somebody to write something about this album, because I think in this community, it's a benchmark album. It's like one that a lot of people gravitate to, and people continue to talk about a lot, even 20 years later. After I wrote the essay about Fountains of Wayne for Go All the Way, this, of all their records, I went back and re-listened to all their records before I interviewed Adam Schlesinger. For some reason, Welcome Interstate Managers just caught me in a way that it hadn't when it first came out. And I went through this like 6 to 9 month period of kind of getting into uh-oh territory with Welcome Interstate Managers, where I started developing really crazy theories about what it was about, that it was an unheralded concept album about the future of rock and roll in the internet age, and these guys totally called where all music was going, and if you put this song with that song, I went off the deep end with how much time and I was spending with this music, and how much energy and thought I was putting into what the songs meant and what these characters, because they developed this incredibly rich universe of characters and character studies in all their albums, but on this album in particular. And so I just bought in to this narrative that I created in my head. So I had worked with Nadia previously on a magazine about power pop, and she had written something fantastic for that. And I was like, man, Nadia would do a good job with this.
Oh.
And so I asked, and Nadia said yes. And I was thrilled. But I was even more thrilled when I got back something so left of center as I synced it up with The Graduate, because it made me feel a little better about how deep I had gone with this record that I love so much.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it speaks to, again, the quality of the music, the character studies, the lyrics, the timeliness of what they were singing about in 2003, what they were grappling with in their own life, and then the mythology that's been built up about the album since, because they, other people have said it sounds like a concept record. And at one point, I believe it was, I'm not sure this is exactly right, but I think Chris Collingwood even said, yeah, it's kind of about a guy who dies on a plane crash, and it's the last second of his life, his life flashing before his eyes. He's made some, I think it was Chris. Is that right, Nadia? Is that?
Wow. Yeah, I think so. I mean, the other thing I know is that the reason why this album has a country song and a old, like, 80s feeling slow song and stuff like that on it is that they did not limit themselves when it comes to writing. So it's surprising how cohesive it is when you have, you could bring in any kind of song you want.
Yeah. I mean, and so when I got the piece that Nadia submitted, I was just like, okay, this is great. It's really in line with how deep I've gone on this record. And it's just nice to know that other people have as well. So I just think it's important to note that, like, there's a specific kind of fan of Fountains of Wayne, but there's also an incredibly specific kind of deep fanship for this specific album and this specific collection of songs that does something to certain kinds of music fans. And I don't really know why that is, but it made me think it was a concept record and made Nadia think it was something you should sync up.
Well, there, I mean, it's funny you say that, because I did hear your podcast when you were talking about the conspiracy of it being a concept record and how worried you were because it was way far out there. There was an early draft I didn't send you of this article, which made it completely into a movie. Where even the album cover is these guys older, and they're singing about their younger life. They come to this conference for Interstate Managers, having had their life over now. You know, the best part of it is over, and they're sitting there and they're just reminiscing about what could have been. And so I had a similar concept. That I was going to write about this album. And then I read it to my husband. And I was like, is this just way too far out? So I didn't go with that one. But then that led me to stumble upon the Graduate sync up.
I don't know, Keith, is any of this making sense to you? I mean, you like
us? It does. But actually what I want to hop on there is, like, hearing you talk about all this stuff, I'm like, ooh, could this be like a Broadway musical?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whether the storyline that I came up with for this concept record is real or not, I definitely have woven a narrative that connects these songs and the characters in these songs. So yes, I think it definitely could be. And I think their songwriting, again, is so fantastic, so unbelievably good. And I don't want to leave aside that the band is also amazing. It's like, in addition to having two of the best songwriters of the last 20 or 25 years, they also, all four of them, were such accomplished and talented musicians. And again, it's that sort of, like, Dali had to, like, figure out how to paint really straight portraiture and landscape art before he could go off and do his own thing. These guys are showing such restraint in what they're capable of, and they make it seem simple. Yeah. But there is so much talent behind it that goes into that seeming simplicity that, like, they're one of the tightest bands on album that you're likely to encounter.
I don't remember who said it, and I'm going to paraphrase it poorly, so my apologies in advance, but you can't fuck up the rules until you know the rules.
That's sort of what I'm getting at. These guys were such students of rock and roll. When I spoke with Adam, he went on and on about how, like, it was the Beatles. The Beatles were clearly the foundation, and whether or not he set out to be a power pop band, or that they set out to be a power pop band, there's no denying the Beatles' influence is huge in their music.
Haley's Waitress was one song that, it's interesting because I've heard a lot of people, especially on other podcasts, really dislike Haley's Waitress.
Haley's Waitress never comes around. She's hiding in the kitchen. She's nowhere to be found. I just want some coffee. Is that too much to ask? Haley's waitress is not up to the task. It's like she's been away for years. It's been so long, so long. Darling, don't you know we miss you when you're gone. So long, so long. Darling, don't you know we miss you when you're gone.
I think it's a beautiful song. When I was thinking of that concept that this is a movie, Haley's Waitress was critical to the plot of that movie, because that was when the main character sees Haley's Waitress and she's a terrible waitress. And I was assuming that she was probably around Stacy's mom's age, and he sees her and she's not paying him any attention. Right? Because she's all into her own world. She's waiting for that big break. And that was when he realizes, oh, he really should have gone for, you know, one of the girls back in Hackensack or Julie, or like any of these other girls that would have been better for him, instead of misplacing his, you know, love with Stacy's mom. So when I thought about it that way, Haley's Waitress was like, thank you for including that, because it really gave my movie a twist.
How far along did you get with this movie?
It's in production.
Yeah, we're shooting it in the backyard right now. Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty in-depth. I'm looking at the song lengths. These songs are tight.
Yeah. Everything about the band is. That's they're not just playing things to play them. They are playing just the right thing at just about every moment. It's kind of astounding to my ears what an amazing band they are. And I think also that doesn't get talked about as much as it deserves to be, because like Jody Porter is an incredible guitar player.
Why do you think Elevator Up was left off the original?
I think they were worried about getting sued by Oasis.
Help me out with that joke. Wait, why?
There are two songs on this album. Elevator Up was only on the Japanese release and I think a digital release.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just when people say that they sound like Oasis, they're talking about that song, Elevator Up, and they're talking about Super Collider.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he even, Chris Collingwood even sings differently on Elevator Up.
Hmm.
But I think that's right there in line with them doing a sort of 70s piano ballad or a straight up honky tonk country song. They were kind of just doing what they wanted, which is another beautiful thing about this record.
For sure. There's a liberation. They're paying for it. They're producing it. Why not? Right.
Yeah.
And I think the parallel you talked about at the top with Wilco is also pretty accurate. Yeah. They were doing what they wanted. And then Warner Brothers was like, no. We don't want this.
Yeah, and both bands had their careers completely transformed by the record that followed being dropped.
Which begs the question, why didn't the A&R guys go to bat for Fountains of Wayne? It's a rhetorical question. We can't answer that. I don't know why, but...
The beautiful thing is the guy who ended up signing them to S-Curve Virgin was the guy who originally signed them to Atlantic. So, like, there's a person who always believed in them. And twice gave them the shot to have the career that I think they deserved. So that's kind of beautiful, right? And then that's another parallel to the Wilco story, because Wilco just re-signs to a smaller subsidiary of their previous label after being dropped. And then, you know, the parallel being that Fountains of Wayne has their old A&R guy sign them to this new label where he's now working.
That's fantastic.
I also think one of the reasons why I like Welcome Interstate Managers so much, to bring it back around to that, is that this album almost didn't happen. And Fountains of Wayne, they might have been no more if this album didn't happen.
Tell me more about that.
You might have read a lot about how Chris Collingwood, and to answer your earlier point, which was like what happened up until the point where Adam passed away, I think they were always agreed that they would go work on their separate projects. And Chris had his own band. And, you know, Adam was doing all the work in film and television. But Chris, because of being dropped by the second album, he was not in a good place. And it was Adam that had to convince him and pull him out and say, come on, let's make a third album. Let's just do it. Right, Steve, do you know more about that?
I don't. When I interviewed Jody for the Big Takeover article that I wrote about this album, he just talked about, listen, our future was completely uncertain, but we just knew that we wanted to keep recording and writing music together. And so I guess in a way it kind of forced them to get back to the roots of what any rock and roll band is, which is four or five people who have some kind of chemistry and share some vision for what they want to accomplish together. They got to do that again. You know, they got to do that for the first two records with Atlantic, and then were forced to sort of do that for the third record that consequently just changed the trajectory of their career. But something you just said, Nadia, really made me think, which was, can you imagine a world where we only got two Fountains of Wayne records? Because that's what was at stake.
Yeah.
That would have been a real bummer.
Yeah.
I mean, be on this podcast right now not saying anything because...
who knows? We might be talking about the first album and... but yeah. No, just but Chris Collingwood had put his entire heart into Utopia Parkway and it just didn't go anywhere. And then they got dropped and... I think, you know, the guy, he, like most artists, suffers from depression. And when that hit him, it was a major blow. And I think he felt like he was done. He had tried the whole music industry and it didn't work out. And I'm pretty sure it was Adam that just pulled him out and went, come on, we can do another album. Probably, maybe it didn't take too much prodding when, you know, it's your friend from childhood and you guys love and respect each other and you have fun together, but yeah, it almost didn't happen.
Well, thank God it did. Often we talk about sequencing of an album. Is there anything on these 16 tracks? Does it flow for you guys or is there anything that you would move around?
Mexican Wine is genius to open with because the first line is he was killed by a cellular phone explosion, which obviously plays to the idea that it's somebody's last second on Earth, right? Because it's blowing up on the plane. Yeah. But
it's like a Tarantino film.
But that's actually the line that sent me on the down the rabbit hole about my theory about the concept record, because I thought he was singing about what was happening in the music industry in 2002 and 2003, which was that digital was taking over.
Yeah.
And that this the formats that they had been used to and the industry that they had entered really was starting to not exist anymore. Regardless of all that, Mexican Wine is a genius way to start this album. Just the feel of it overall, the sort of recklessness of the lyrical content, you know, is like, I'm just going to drink, right? You know, and then Bright Future in Sales really sets up thematically a lot of what this album is talking about, right? Careerism, Gen X coming to terms with, you just have to get a job and be a cubicle dweller, right? I think, and then Stacy's Mom is just the, like, I mean, to put it third, which parallels your third record theory, that song being third is exactly perfect because they're going to give you two songs first of what you come to expect from previous Fountains of Wayne record. And then they're going to just raise their two middle fingers to the guy that dropped them at their last label and go, and now here's our hit.
Right? We don't hear a single.
Right. So you get these first three songs, in my opinion, that are just like, three knockout punches, man.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And then against all odds, probably the best song on the record
is
the fourth one. which is Hackensack, which is just an unbelievable little 3-minute slice of songcraft.
It's a beautiful song.
I used to know you when we were young. You were in all my dreams. We sat together in period one, Fridays at 8:15. Now I see your face in the strangest places, movies and magazines. I saw you talking to Christopher Walken on my TV screen. But I will wait for you as long as I need to. And if you ever get back to Hackensack, I'll be here for you.
I don't know, Nadia, what do you think about the track list? It's hard to unwind your fandom from it, how the record goes.
When I was going off my, you know, bender on the movie idea, I kind of both loved and hated the order of the tracks. You know, he was killed by a cellular phone explosion was like, okay, so we open with the death scene and then we come back and, you know, steal a page from Quentin Tarantino. I think those, I mean, you can't do better than those first 9 tracks. Mm-hmm. And it really, I think one of the reasons why people don't like Haley's Waitress as much as I do is because it's just such a shift from those first 9 songs that are really powerful, really well written, really well crafted. I do want to talk about that. Besides the killed by a cellular phone explosion, the other greatest line in lyric history is that supposed to be your poker face or was someone just run over by a train? I mean, that's a brilliant line. Also, that line happens in when Mrs. Robinson and Benjamin are both in the same room and they're trying to figure out, are you being seduced? It's so good. Is that supposed to be your poker face? Or was someone run over by a train? I think it's when Mrs. Robinson gets like naked and runs to the room.
Oh God. It's horrible. Now, Nadia, have you tried this with any other Fountains of Wayne albums with other movies perhaps?
No, that's going the extra mile. I only go that extra mile for Steve. So
and it is very much appreciated.
No, I mean, I knew that, you know, Steve knew this album so well, and him asking me was, you know, a huge compliment and trust in my abilities as a writer. And so I knew I had to bring something new. I could have written 100, you know, words about this album and how great it is and how it's lasted the test of time and Stacy's mom and all that other stuff. But I wanted to have a unique take that I hoped he hadn't heard before.
And I had not, and I loved it. But it's right in line with what I want these journals to be, right? Because it's just a labor of love. This is not going to like be on some like bestseller list somewhere. It's a very niche topic and niche collection of essays about written by super fans about something that pretty much only they care about or a very small group of people care about. But I always just tell people, write the best that you can and have the most unique and interesting perspective that you possibly can. And that's usually the guidance I give people about contributing. And again, Nadia's essay was just so great and so over the top and so wonderful. I really enjoyed it. I just reread it again before we started talking. Brought a smile to my face again.
How did you get introduced to Fountains of Wayne? What was the first song that you heard? And sub question, did it bowl you over?
Radiation Vibe, and yes, I could not believe that people were making music that sounded like that.
Wow. Okay.
It was from the first album, and it was either Sink to the Bottom or what album is I'm just a Hat and Feet. What album is that from? Is that the first one or
Hat and Feet is the fourth song on Utopia Parkway?
Yeah, it's the second one. that was just a song that just kept getting stuck in my head until I found out what it was about, and then it stopped being stuck in my head. I think it was about someone I think who like died, and all that was left of this person was a hat and feet.
Oh,
it's really morbid.
Kind of grim, but here we are laughing about it. Like, oh, that's grim.
Warning, should be a warning on this podcast. But no, probably Sink to the Bottom.
Okay,
that's my first. And I did think, like, I liked them, but this band was just one of those things that just kind of continued to grow on me until now. They're in my top favorite bands, and I think it was because they were very silly, and Chris's singing is amazing and unique, but it's not like listening to a Keen album, you know, where it's just got layers and depths and stuff like that. But now I find myself reaching constantly for Fountains of Wayne albums to make my day feel better.
Wow.
Radiation Vibe was just a really good pop rock song, right? Like everything about it, the title's cool, the guitar line's cool, the groove is cool. And then you go Sink to the Bottom, you're like, oh, okay, that's kind of their heavier, darker, slower, dirgier one. And then you're like Joe Ray, and you're like, okay, this is very specific lyrical content here. They're telling a story. And then that kind of just brings you in to their world of these character studies and these quirky lyrics. Nobody quite puts together those elements quite like these guys, so that on the first record, by the time you get to the song Leave the Biker, which if you hear that first, you would just be like, oh, it's a joke song. But because of the 8 songs that led up to it, it's perfect. It's like you had to listen to it. You had to be brought into the fold of their approach, their very specific approach to pop music. And then you're like, no, Leave the Biker's genius, right? And there's just something about this band, for at least for me, and I think for similar to fans with a similar ear for this kind of music, they just draw you in.
That's amazing that bands can do that.
I don't know how.
I certainly have no idea. You're a musician, Steve. I don't know how.
I'm a drummer, so let's just slow down a little bit.
Well, you said it, not me.
I've heard them all, buddy.
We talk about what an amazing band this is, right? It's definitely lightning in a bottle, right? These 4 guys.
Yeah.
And one of them is from the Posies, too, or used to be with the Posies. So to me, that's just an extra element, because the Posies are part of my musical power pop DNA that I love. They're one of the bands that brought me up to Seattle from L.A., made me go check out this Seattle thing. But it's these 4 super talented guys that eventually they're going to write a song that makes you know they don't take themselves too seriously. Right? It's tongue in cheek. They're amazingly good at what they do, but they're not taking themselves seriously. And I love that. I love that.
I hear a Beatles parallel. I notice the songs are written by, you know, 2 people, 4 talented musicians.
Oh, yeah.
The sum is greater than the parts. There's some cheekiness in there. There's some depth to it. Has anyone done a deep dive and a parallel between the Beatles and these guys?
Worst thing you can do to any band is compare them to the Beatles. It's like that is the kiss of death, to compare a band to the Beatles.
Well, I can edit that out.
The Beatles are this incredible pinnacle high watermark, and bands that get compared to the Beatles generally don't fare well. Like, how can you compare to the Beatles? They're the Beatles. They are an unassailable cultural force that set the template that any band is going to fall potentially into or near. And so you do a new band a disservice by comparing them, a newer band a disservice by comparing them to the unattainable.
Yeah, and the Beatles are such an old band. They would never have a number one hit in 2023. Wait a second.
Chronic migraine is 15 or more headache days a month, each lasting 4 hours or more.
Botox, onabotulinum toxin A, prevents headaches in adults with chronic migraine. It's not for adults with migraine with 14 or fewer headache days a month. It prevents, on average, 8 to 9 headache days a month versus 6 to 7 for placebo.
Prescription Botox is injected by your doctor. Effects of Botox may spread hours to weeks after injection, causing serious symptoms. Alert your doctor right away as difficulty swallowing, speaking, breathing, eye problems, or muscle weakness can be signs of a life-threatening condition. Patients with these conditions before injection are at highest risk. Side effects may include allergic reactions, neck and injection site pain, fatigue, and headache. Allergic reactions can include rash, welts, asthma symptoms, and dizziness. Don't receive Botox if there's a skin infection. Tell your doctor your medical history, muscle or nerve conditions, including ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, myasthenia gravis or Lambert-Eaton syndrome, and medications, including botulinum toxins, as these may increase the risk of serious side effects.
Ask your doctor and visit BotoxChronicMigraine.com or call 1-800-44-BOTOX to learn more.
So, Keith, Welcome Interstate Managers now your favorite record of all time? And why is the answer yes? Have we convinced you? Has our sales pitch gotten through?
I don't know what it is, Steve. I'll be perfectly honest with you. Power pop is a really hard thing for me. But when it does hit me, like Great Buildings, I think Great Buildings is just a phenomenal record. Dungeon of Skeletons, phenomenal record. I can't explain what it is about the genre that I have a hard time with. Because it works. In everything that I like, short songs. I don't like a lot of bloviating. Have you sold me on it? You've sold me on it, because I think I didn't realize, I made reference to this a little bit earlier, I didn't realize the loss of Adam Schlesinger until probably a year after the fact. I had no idea this guy had his hand in everything. He was easily one of the most talented men of our generation, you know?
Oh, everything he did was incredible. The songs he gave away were incredible. There's a commercial, the zombie commercial or something that he wrote for, and I looked it up the other day. If you just type like zombie commercial Adam Schlesinger, it'll come up. And the song that he like wrote in the day for that was mind-blowingly good.
Yeah. Pluggables. What do you guys got to plug, Steve?
Yeah, I'm having a really great time over on my Substack newsletter. I'm writing a lot of stuff over there. I'm having a lot of guest posts from people. Mo Troper just wrote something about the Now and Then by the Beatles that was really thought-provoking and deep. He's a deep Beatles fan.
He's also a John Bryan fan.
Oh yeah, he's about to release a record of John Bryan covers. I just had somebody write about the three-night run of Marvelous Three reunion shows in Atlanta. So trying to make more of a community out of it. And then we have the semi-annual journal that's spun out of the newsletter. And we've had two volumes of that. And the third volume of that will be coming out in March or April of 2024.
Awesome. And Nadja?
I have quite a few things going. So my day job is working for a company called Archie McPhee. And our title is We Make Weird. And I made the world's largest rubber chicken, 7 feet tall there. I do crafting, weird crafting. I made a pageant crown for a local drag show called Bacon Strip out of a Home Depot air conditioning duct. And because of all these skills of crafting that I've always had, I'm putting a studio together and I'm going to start my own YouTube crafting show.
Oh, wow.
So we're in the midst of trying to get the studio built, and then I'll light it, and then I'll start shooting episodes of that. So it's not music, but it's crafting. Musically, I keep doing shows for Luxuria Music. I have a show called Hop On, and I play with whatever genre or thing I want. My last show was Hop On the Mellotron. So I played all these like great songs that the Mellotron is featured in. And then, let's see, lastly, trying to get my own autobiography published about my time in the film industry and all kinds of other fun stuff. So I've got, like Steve, I have a lot going on too.
Well, that's awesome.
Never bored.
No. Thank you both very much for coming on and discussing this wonderful album. I will continue my journey into power pop.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Keith, thanks so much for having us on. I love the show, and I always love coming back. So thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
DirecTV Stream has the most local MLB games, which means it's never been easier to
root for the home team.
So whether you're rooting for a or even a
strike three,
or a
it's out of here.
Root for your home team with DirecTV Stream, the most MLB games, period. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Many thanks to Steve for suggesting this episode and opening our ears to the wider sonic palette of Fountains of Wayne. And thank you to both Nadja and Steve for their time and insight into this incredible album. You can order a physical copy of Remember the Lightning, a Guitar Pop Journal. We have a link for it in our notes. We also have a link to the Substack Journal. We have links to both Steve and Nadja's work there too. I guess what we're saying is, don't ignore the show notes.
This episode of Abandoned Albums was written and produced by Keith R. Higgins. The show was recorded at Thunderlove Studio, where it was engineered by
Daphne Morris,
with help from
John Thomas.
Abandoned Albums was edited by
Mike Hunt.
Our theme song is Booty Cooler by Shuggy Otis. In the opening of the show, the songs you heard were Rumble by Link Ray, 16 Tons by Tennessee Ernie Ford, and the Carpenters' classic Top of the World, performed by Shonen Knife. You can stream all of those songs and artists wherever you stream your favorite music.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino.
You heard the following songs during this podcast: Stacy's Mom and Hey Julie from the Fountains of Wayne album Welcome Interstate Managers. You also heard Joe Ray off of the band's self-titled debut album and It Must Be Summer from Utopia Parkway. Then we return to Welcome Interstate Managers for Haley's Waitress and Hackensack. You can stream the entire Fountains of Wayne catalog wherever you stream your favorite music. The show notes for this episode has links to everything you heard and that was discussed during this episode. Please remember to support independent artists.
If you like what you've heard, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating. It really does help. Thanks for listening.
Grazie.
Daily Leaf. Rob Janicki. Mike Pellegrino. Therina Bella. Ronnie Barnett. S.W. Loudon. Michael Janicki. Peyton Janicki. And our executive producer.
This is Thunderwolf.
Abandoned Albums receives funding from Damon Pharmaceuticals, the makers of Ben Affleck. Ben Affleck is the only chewable tablet made to combat stomach unease associated with mediocrity. Taken daily, Ben Affleck can help combat explosive gastrointestinal shame. You can find a multitude of flavors in the incontinence section of your local pharmacy. Ben Affleck, save yourself the embarrassment.
The side effects include dry mouth, headache, anal leakage, muscle soreness, bad decisions, gender confusion, constipation, evil spirit possession, and banality. Use only as directed.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Paw Print Media.